I am going to start this message by simply stating the obvious. 2020, the year 2020, has certainly been for many a tough year. I have no idea your thoughts in terms of anticipating 2020, but I thought to myself, there's something about this year that just feels like it's going to be good, and how wrong I was. You know, I just, to gain perspective, I want to read from just a few articles that have been published over the last 2-3 months, just to give us a sense of perspective in terms of what we've experienced over the last little while, the last few months. This is from the Associated Press, July 13th, 2020. The resurgence of the coronavirus in the United States ignited fierce debate Monday about whether to reopen schools as global health officials warned that the pandemic will intensify unless more countries adopt comprehensive plans to combat it. If the basics aren't followed, there's only one way this pandemic is going to go. This comes from the director of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. Further down the article, I'll just pull a short snippet from a paragraph that shows up. While it's too soon to assess the full impact of the lockdowns and other containment measures, the agency, that would be the World Health Organization, has said at a minimum another 83 million people would go hungry as a result of the pandemic, and they go into a longer explanation about this. I went to a local source, this one being from July 22nd, 2020. This happens to be from Fox 12 News Oregon. It's a news outlet. There is a frustration growing about protests in downtown Portland that have turned violent over the past few nights. People across the area have reached out to Fox 12 wondering if it will stop, curious if the original message is getting lost. The images out of downtown Portland have been a point of political discussions across the state and country. Businesses in the downtown core remain boarded, with many saying that they have been like this for weeks after protests turned into riots over the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. In the last few weeks, the flashpoint has been between protesters and federal police in front of the federal courthouse. Those demonstrations have ended with tear gas and fireworks. I don't have to tell you about what's happening there. I'm going to drop down to one quote by Marilyn George, who offers the following. She says she doesn't feel safe going to the downtown Portland area anymore. She questions the messages behind the protest. She says, I'm angry at this point, and I'm not really sure that anyone cares or anyone's going to do anything about this. I think you already know we are 100 days into the protests in Portland, believe it or not, with a whole lot of violence and death involved. And from one additional article, this one comes from the USA Today, August 30th, 2020. Monroe, Louisiana, the state's Hurricane Laura death toll rose recently to 14 Sunday as cleanup efforts were hampered by power outages that may last a month, and dry water spigots in many of the hardest hit areas. More than 350,000 Louisiana residents remained without electricity on Sunday, while 87 water systems serving upwards of 150,000 people have remained inoperable. And I could keep reading. I'm going to ask, if you will, with that background, to go with me to Acts 3. Let's go read God's word, if you will. We'll go to Acts 3 and we'll start there. You know, in Acts 2, this is the Feast of Pentecost that's recorded. And if you're in Acts 3 with me, we are going to see in Acts 3 a man who's been crippled from birth. And crippled from birth in a case like this, Peter and John heal. Everyone in Jerusalem knew about this man. I can't say everyone had walked by him, but many knew of the fact that he could only pull himself up and down and could do no more. And so what you find in the first several verses, and I'll only start with verse 1. Now, Peter and John went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. So that would be the afternoon. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they had laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms. He was a beggar, from those who entered the temple. And what we wind up seeing is Peter and John are allowed to perform a miracle. This man is given the ability to stand and move. And if you keep dropping down, say to verse 6, I'm at verse 6, then Peter said, silver and gold I do not have. Everyone said, how in the world did you do this? Peter said, silver and gold I do not have, but what I do have I give to you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. So forgive me. This was the point at which he was given the power to walk by God's Spirit. God involved here by the power of God. And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up. And immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. And so, leaping up, stood and walked, and entered the temple with them, walking and leaping and praising God. Everyone would have had to have been in disbelief. This gets around very rapidly, no surprise. This individual who had never had the capacity to walk is now leaping and walking into the temple. And if you drop with me to verse 11, we'll keep reading. Now, as the lame man who was healed held on to Peter and John, all the people, we talked about a flashlight. Do you have a flashlight? There are shades here in terms of this lectern that it's shadowing, and maybe this is me getting old, though I don't want to admit it. And I don't know how to turn the lights on brighter here. We don't have the capacity to turn the lights on brighter. I have no idea how long my phone will last. Give me a sec. We're going to use the flashlight here so I can read. Okay, now there are words on the page. Okay, great. Now, as the lame man who was healed held on to Peter and John, all the people ran together to them in the porch, which is called Solomon's, greatly amazed. So we happen to know by background that this porch happened to have been a part of the old Solomon temple. And if I remember right, it was the east side of the temple. It's what had remained. But everyone knew of this portion of the temple. So they all ran here because they wanted to see this guy. So when Peter saw it, he responded to the people, men of Israel, why do you marvel at this? Or why look so intently at us as though by our own power or godliness we had made this man walk? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered. Boy, this gets pointed here. Who you delivered up and denied in the presence of Pilate when he was determined to let him go. This is only roughly 50 days removed. Boy, did they feel this one were accounted? You bet they did. Because they had just seen Christ crucified, what? Not even 2 months prior, roughly. But you denied the Holy One and the Just and asked for a murderer to be granted to you and killed the Prince of Life whom God raised up from the dead, of which we are witnesses. And verse 16 reads, and his name, through faith in his name, has made this man strong, whom you see and know. Yes, in the faith which comes through him. Thank you. Hey, that works. That's quite good. I'll just stick it under here. Thank you, sir. How can I get an angle that works here? I'm going to have fun with this for a second. I may look like Moses coming down from the mountain here if it shines off of my face. So I'll keep reading. Verse 16. Yes, the face which comes through him has given him the perfect soundness in the presence of you all. And what I'm headed for, which is ultimately what we're after, is verse 19. So here's his message from all of this. Repent, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, so that the times of, here's where I'm going, refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord. 20. And that he may send Jesus Christ, who was preached to you before, whom heaven must receive until the time of restoration of all things which God has spoken by the mouth of all his prophets since the world began. What Christ was telling them is he was saying, repent and be baptized. The times of refreshing and restoring are coming. You know, in just 2 weeks, we begin the fall feasts. Like the man we see in Acts 3, I can't imagine a better message to focus on, particularly based upon what we've experienced, say, over the last 6 months, than a message that's refreshing and restorative. Because all we see in the media today is the opposite. So what I'm going to ask that we do today, even as we saw this man healed, restored to complete bodily function, though he hadn't been able to walk before, that we focus on a message of restoration. And that message of restoration involves these fall feasts that are upcoming. These feasts that have been prophesied, the meaning of them has been prophesied for millennia. 4 straight feasts we have that focus on refreshment and restoration. So I then transition and ask you the following question. Are you ready for these feasts? Are you ready for these feasts? I have 5 questions for you today to answer. I'm going to pose 5 questions, and they're the same questions that I'll answer on my own, to determine if you are prepared for these upcoming feasts that begin in just 2 weeks. Let's go with question 1. Question 1, do you know why we keep the fall feasts? Do you know why we keep the fall feasts? You know, as we anticipate the fall feasts, it's easy to get caught up. I get this. Easy to get caught up in what we're going to do for the latter 2 feasts. The Feast of Trumpets, that's an easy one. We're here, it's nearby. We'll be over at Unity Atlanta in a couple weeks. The other one, Atonement, is a little bit more of a challenge. We know this because it requires us to do something. But at times we can, even as we anticipate the fall feast, we can get lost in the fact of where we're going. What are we going to do when we get there? What are we going to eat when we're there? And we can miss the purpose of these feasts. Go with me to Leviticus 23. Now, we're not going to nearly do an exhaustive job in terms of the focus that's offered here in Leviticus 23 and the focus of the messages that will take place on those days, each feast. But it is helpful for us to understand why we keep these fall feasts, to be reminded of this. Because even as I was listening to Mr. Steve Myers speak, and I, like many of you, I grew up in the church. I've heard this my entire life. And I found myself, even while he was speaking, being reminded of a book that came out years ago that was really about the Underground Railroad. And the name of the book, which for whatever reason stuck with me, was Hidden in Plain Sight. How many people have a Bible on their shelf and no idea what's in that Bible? I was reading a statistic yesterday that said even over the course of the last 6 months, separate from the fact that in many cases we couldn't attend services, that churches are estimating there's already a 30% fall in attendance. Already, based upon surveys they've run. And yet you and I, and here's kind of the catch, you and I come to services, have been called, and we can sometimes take for granted the tremendous blessing we've been given to know what's going on over the next month, month and a half with these fall feasts. So I pose the question, why do we keep these feasts? Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. My answer is not going to be fancy because God's answer is not fancy here. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. You didn't come up with these. This isn't some wonderful Mardi Gras party that I learned yesterday. I guess Toronto does that. A Mardi Gras party to die for. Okay? I don't know how Toronto got the Mardi Gras party. But we didn't come up with these days. God came up with them. He's just revealed to us what they entail. In fact, if I read from the NIV version, the exact same verses here, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, these are my appointed festivals, the appointed festivals of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies. You know, this notion of feast, appointed times, is the term in Hebrew, moed. It's not us. It's not our time. We didn't come up with these. God came up with them. It's our responsibility then to keep them, to follow them, to be sure that we're there in sacred assembly meeting on those days, because God's provided this instruction. We didn't come up with that. Now, you can comb through the verses here, and I won't go through all of them, but if you drop down even in Leviticus 23, say to verse 23 and 24, we see the Feast of Trumpets listed. You can see there the language, verse 24, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial of blowing trumpets. Why do we keep trumpets? Well, it celebrates a time yet ahead when Christ will return with the sound of a trumpet. Did we make that up? I didn't make that up. I'm not taking credit for that. There's no way. That feast reminds us that he will, despite the mess we see, that he will intervene and he will fix things. Atonement. You can read in verse 27, the tenth day of the seventh month shall be the day of atonement. Shall be a holy convocation. You shall afflict your souls. What's that mean? You go without eating. This isn't the intermittent fasting that's so popular today. This is God saying, don't eat. Remember me for 24 hours. You won't die. And you know what you'll do? You'll be quickly reminded of how human you are. What does it remind us of? It reminds us, even as we move forward, that at a point yet ahead, that we will be reconciled with Jesus Christ and God the Father, because Satan the devil will be removed. That's what we focus on that day. Let's say you go to verse 33 forward. We see the Feast of Tabernacles spoken of. And we know that that's the time where we see in Scripture that a time of peace and of safety will take place under Christ who has returned to this earth. We will be under Christ's government. It will be a time like nothing we have today. We live in a time of tohu and bohu. It's constant chaos. You know, I was laying there, and you may do this sometimes. I was laying there in bed and thought, you know what's changed? And you already know this. You know what's changed pretty dramatically over the last 20, 25, 30 years? Is when some chaotic event takes place, we oftentimes had, if we go back, we oftentimes had a newspaper or a news report on that. Today, what do we have? We have a flurry of activity. We have phones out, footage out, every slant of the story coming out. Talk about, you know, a density, a layer, all this layering of information that we have to wade through. If it feels chaotic, it's because it is chaotic. Human beings operate chaotically. So it's really not a surprise that we kind of feel like this. Will God's kingdom, will the establishment of God's government at Christ's return feel that way? No. And I really have to wonder, is the first thing he's going to yank out of our hands those phones? I don't know. I really don't know, because they do wonderful things for us. I mean, I contact my family. We're not tweeting, but I'm texting all the time. It does all these wonderful things. Camera with my dad and mom. But will he say, I don't know if those were such a good idea? I don't have that answer. But what I do know is the chaos we experience today, the internal conflict we oftentimes feel, that'll subside. My dad sometimes would say, you need to get a hold of that. That phrase always makes me laugh. You need to get a hold of that. Christ will get a hold of that. Because there won't be that feel. There won't be that chaos. And so what we find here, even in the Feast of Tabernacles, if you go down or you lead up to the eighth day that's listed in verses 35 and 36 there, in terms of details of what we are to keep and why we're to keep them, that eighth day offers a reminder that judgment will be coming at the end of that 1,000 years. But at the same time with that judgment, billions of people will be given an opportunity to become a part of the family of God. Everyone who's had no idea, their time's coming. You know, I note all these things, and I would just interject or ask us to read verse 37 before we transition out of this point. Verse 37, these are the feasts of the Lord. They're not our feasts, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations to offer an offering made by fire. And then it lists those offerings there. Here's our opportunity to go to these feasts, to attend them, to observe them, and give offerings that say thank you to God, that show appreciation. So question one I've asked you here is, do you know why we keep the feasts? And I would trust in our heads that we've already thought through them. We keep them because they're God's ordained feasts. And they remind us of the wonderful plan God has in motion. It may not always work on our time schedule. Sometimes we want things faster or slower. But God reminds us annually that we are to observe these days as a reminder of that wonderful plan of salvation, a plan to save all of humanity. So that's question one. Let's go to question two. Have you prepared physically and spiritually for the fall feast? Have you prepared physically and spiritually for the fall feast? Well, let's go by definition what the term prepare means. Merriam-Webster's dictionary, to make ready beforehand for some purpose, use, or activity. To make ready beforehand for some purpose, use, or activity. So we might break this down into two sub-questions. Are you prepared physically for the feast? Well, we know that the Feast of Trumpets and Atonement are kept in our local areas, I've already noted. The last two, they have their own set of instructions. We'll be there soon enough. We'll focus on those, even as we were able to kind of survey them. The Feast of Tabernacles and Eighth Day offer separate instructions. Go with me, if you will, to Deuteronomy 14. We'll go to Deuteronomy 14. And we're going to read the fact that we've been preparing for these days for a long time, particularly for the Feast of Tabernacles and that eighth day. If you're over in Deuteronomy 14, you know that God has commanded that we keep offerings. And if you're dropping down with me to Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, you can read with me there if you will. And you shall tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces by the year, year by year. We know this to be an agrarian society. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses. Did we come up with the place? No, we did not. Now, God establishes the church in order to determine what place we meet, but they do that even based upon lots of prayer, lots of consideration, considering all number of factors. Did we come up with the places? No. We're the place he chooses to make his name abide, that the tithes of your grain and your new wine and your oil of the firstlings of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to do what? To fear the Lord your God always. You know, the interesting part about this tithe is it is not the same tithe that's noted in Numbers 18 and 19. That was a tithe specifically for the Levitical priesthood and for the upkeep of the temple. This is not that tithe. That was noted as one that's holy to God. This is a different tithe. This is a tithe for you. Has God come up with a beautiful system so that you can keep a portion of your money all year long? And at a time when he says, go and rejoice, you don't have to go into debt. Do you know how rare that is today? I think the average American, what are we, like $17,000, $18,000 in debt? The average American. And that's separate from the fact that with the federal government, what they've estimated, we are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt there. Okay? God has set up a system where if you keep a portion of your monies, give first tithe to the church and keep a second tithe, that when he says go to the feast, it's not like, I can't go, I don't have money. God says, I've had you preparing the whole time for this. You can go. You can go to a location that I've specified. Verse 24, but if the journey is too long, that you may not be able to carry the tithe. Again, that agrarian society, there were times that they could take flocks and herds, whatever it might be. They could take grains. If that wasn't the case, that you could exchange that. And that's what we see here, and it fits our modern society. For if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it. This is what we do. We keep our money all year. Take the money in your hand and go to the place in which the Lord your God chooses. And you got to love this next line because it's so wonderful how God offers this. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. That almost seems too good to be true. For oxen or for sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and he says, have a terrible time. Doesn't say that, does he? He says, rejoice. Rejoice, you and your household. He says, go have a great time. That's amazing how God does this. He has a perfect system set up so that you can go have a good time and not worry about the bill when you get home. Wonder if your card has been overcharged or you've exceeded the limit on that card. He doesn't have it set up that way. You know, there's a separate verse that fits here, only as a reminder, because what we do, and it's beautiful that God does this, is he has us plan through and think through where are we going, how much can we afford, where are we going to stay, which is all good and right. And he set up a system so that we don't have to worry about it. I'm headed for Deuteronomy 30, verses 19 and 20. We oftentimes read verse 19 because it's a memory verse. It's about the fact that God places, gives you and me the opportunity to choose. Verse 19 reads this way. This is going to be real familiar. I call heaven and earth as a witness to you today against you that I have set before you. I'm giving you the opportunity to choose life and death. Set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, he tells us, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. He, in essence, is telling us to go to the feast to live. Unlike what we've been doing, I say unlike, we've been under a lot of burdens the last 6 months. Been a lot of bad news. A lot of bad days. You've shared this with me. There have been a lot of days where I just thought, I just don't want to see the news for like a week. Because it just is driving me nuts here. You know, we oftentimes don't read the next verse. I'm going to add verse 20. That you may, why do we do these things in terms of choosing? That you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, and that you may cling to him. Why? For he is your life and the length of your days, that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. God is, for us, our life. And so when he set up a system that we can go and enjoy the feast, we certainly should do so. We've kept that offering all year. We've prepared ourselves physically. I'm going to ask if you go with me to Nehemiah. Nehemiah 8. Nehemiah Nehemiah 8. Now you remember the Ezra and Nehemiah. This sounds terrible. I can't find Nehemiah. It's probably never happened to you. There. I'm in Nehemiah. I knew it was here. I looked at it earlier. Nehemiah 8. Do you remember by background what's offered here in Nehemiah 8? Oh, if you remember, Judah had been in captivity for some time. They were allowed to come back to Jerusalem in order to build, to rebuild. And what we see here is a reaction of the people when given the opportunity to rebuild. And if you start with me in Nehemiah 8, verse 1, the captives are coming back. Nehemiah 8, verse 1, all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate, and they told Ezra, the scribe, to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded. So Ezra, the priest, brought the law. And you can see this, a congregation of men. I must have missed something here. I had to have read over something that I was thinking about. Of men and women and all who could hear with understanding. There it is, on the first day of the seventh month. I knew trumpets was in here somewhere. It's listed right there in verse 2, tail end of 2. So I note that by background because the Feast of Trumpets was listed. Now, by background, they had, in captivity, they had kind of, by word of mouth, oral history, they'd forgotten a lot. They come back, and they have Ezra here reading, expounding, and we see, and we're reminded, and we'll see this even more as we head for these days, the Feast of Tabernacles. We're reminded that they're going to come to a realization like, we could have been doing this all along. And if you drop to verse 13, we'll go way ahead here. Now on the second day, this now being the Feast of Tabernacles, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people with the priests and Levites were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. Been a long time. They were hearing things that were like, what in the world? We could have, should have been doing this stuff? And they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded to Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should announce and proclaim it in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go to the mountain and bring olive branches, branches of olive trees, myrtle trees, all these branches down and make booths, the tail end of 15. It's written, you're going to build a temporary dwelling. Then the people went out and brought them and made themselves booths, each one on the roof of his house, or in the courtyards, or in the courts of the houses of God, in the open courts of the water gate, and in the open square of the gate of Ephraim. You can almost get a sense that all these booths start popping up everywhere. They have no sense necessarily, until Ezra explains this, that those booths are representative of our lives. We're only here for a short time. Even if you think about this, even them pulling the branches off of the trees, those booths had to look different from the time they built them all the way through the eighth day. They would have gone from probably green and supple, beautiful leaves to kind of brownish as they would have aged. They would have been reminded vividly by what they were watching about how temporary our lives are. Verse 17, so the whole congregation of those who had returned from captivity made booths and sat under the booths, for since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until the day the children of Israel had not done so. And there was very great gladness. And so what they begin to understand is the blessing of keeping these days. And you can see them in terms of days prescribed in verse 18. What we should be reminded is there was very great gladness. So too, even as we look forward to celebrating the feast, there will be very great gladness. In fact, I can't imagine, or I can't think, I say can't imagine, it's been a long time. I think that I've heard you, and I as well, have so looked forward to the feast. In a long time. Because of all we've been through lately. Are we still cautious? Do we still recognize in some places we're going to go, we'll have masks available? Yeah, get all that. But after what we've gone through, even the last 6 months, I can imagine how many smiling faces, if in this case we're wearing masks, smiling eyes, there will be when we walk through those doors for services. So I ask, are we physically prepared for the fall feasts? How about, are we spiritually prepared for the fall feasts? And this really fits that last question I posed, or the first question I posed, why we keep it. Again, we keep it to obey God and to review His plan once more. I sent out in my announcements last evening on purpose, if you haven't had an opportunity to think about what's upcoming, God's Holy Day Plan booklet that I sent out by hyperlink, pages 28 to 52, even if you have a chance to read that between now and the Feast of Trumpets, a beautiful read, a reminder of what we're about to do. Or I also hyperlink this, Lesson 12 of the UCG's Bible Study Course, pages 9 to 16. Go read that as a reminder spiritually what we're preparing for. I know both. If you happen to do the second one, there is an online test. It's really the reason why I would offer that, even in announcements, is as a reminder that it's valuable that we just not show up. I still have a colleague who was at Illinois State University with me, and I used to laugh when I would go sit in his office because his name used to be on everything. And I would say to him, I'll name him Bob. I'll change his name. Not Bob McCurdy. Bob. I'd say, Bob, how do you do all this? He said, 80% of this is just showing up. And I'd say, but that kind of worries me because it lets me know that when you're there, you may or may not be invested all the time. And his comment was, I'm invested when I need to be invested. I thought, that's not really giving me a whole lot of confidence in what committees you're on. But that said, the idea that we show up for the feast shouldn't be our aim. Now, sometimes I get this. When you're a family with like four kids or five kids, you're just trying to herd all the cats there. I get that part. But God has given you and me a beautiful opportunity, even through the Feast of Trumpets and Atonement, as we anticipate the Feast of Tabernacles and Eighth Day, to prepare ourselves spiritually. So let me just pose some questions here. Are we studying the meaning of these days in advance? I'll let you answer that. Are we praying about these days and their meaning? Are we praying that the messages are inspired? Are we meditating on what these days mean spiritually? Are we anticipating what it's like when we walk through the door that first evening with the first service at the Feast of Tabernacles? Are we planning to get to services early enough so that we're prepared to take in spiritually what God will inspire His messages? Are we anticipating those voices singing in unison that we hear at the feast? I note all that just to kind of get your imagination going, because spiritually we need to prepare ourselves for this. It shouldn't just be show up. It should be by the time we're there, we are ready. We are locked and loaded and ready to go. So I ask you, are you preparing physically and spiritually for the fall feast? You're the one who answers that. Let's go to question three. Are you planning to make the fall feast family time? Family time. It's possible to observe the feast and really miss that they're all about family, whether you know it or not. And here's where I guess I'm going to throw guys under the bus. I'm one of them. It is easy to do this. It's easy to go to the feast and say, I got it. I know what I'm doing at the feast. I am volunteering for everything. I am going to walk out of here with my wings on and my halo tuned up. Because I'm going to knock it all out. I'm doing service, everything. Look out, world. There is a danger to that. And when I say that, I'm not telling the guys or the females in the room to not volunteer. But there is a danger at times for us overcommitting to any number of projects. In fact, we'll talk briefly about service a little bit later on. But what I would ask that you do, that we do as families, that we prioritize what our families need in addition to serving. that we think about this. Because the lessons that we see, the lesson that we see particularly, not even through trumpets, which is really a spiritual family affair if you think about it. First fruits are family members rising in the air to meet Christ. Atonement, that's a family affair. Removing Satan from the equation, that's a family affair. The feast is certainly a family affair. Do we understand that the feast is really about some phrase we used to use all the time? We are family. That's what it's about. That's what the feast is about. It is family time. So when I note that, you can go to a number of places in Scripture that talk about this. I'll ask that we go to Malachi 2, just one. Whether you go to Matthew 19, which talks about the importance of the marital unit, or Psalm 127, where we see that children are a blessing from God and a reward. Over in Malachi 2, we're reminded of just a simple verse that shows up here. Malachi is the last book, he tells himself, in the Old Testament. Malachi 2, verses 13 and 14. Malachi 2, verses 13 and 14. These few verses here are really beautiful. And this is the second thing you do. I'm in Malachi 2, verse 13. And cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping. So I have to remember by background here. If you remember, Judah was mourning because of the consequences they had experienced in terms of captivity. If it helps, because we have to find ourselves some context here. What God tells us here is the realization of the importance he places on family. With weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore. In other words, they had been... They had disregarded God. They had minimized what God had done. Nor receive it with good will from your hands. Yet you say, for what reason? Because God has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth. He grounds this. This is interesting that he does this. He grounds this in the marital unit, in husbands and wives, in the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. You've been negative. You've hurt her. And then you can read the latter end here, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. And what we find here, even as you drop down, why does this all take place? I'm in verse 15. But he did not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit. And why one? Why does God have families? Because he's about godly offspring. That's what the feast is about. Family time, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. So what we get through all of this is a reminder that even as we anticipate the feast and we think through what's here, it is family time. God expects us to go to the feast and spend time with our family. It's a time when our activities should be constructive and productive and gratifying. They should be activities that even afterward, whether it be phone snapshots, or however we record the event later on, where we think back and go, yeah, I remember last year in Gatlinburg. Man, that was a lot of fun. Wasn't that fun? Where we spent time with family. Our focus then needs to be on sharing time with those closest to us. Well, how does this then connect, say, with our spiritual family? Because there's something to be said here. Are we supposed to spend time with our spiritual family? Yes, we are. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14. We didn't read. I stopped purposely. I was not trying to be conniving. But we didn't keep reading here about what God allows you to do with that tithe. Remember that tithe we read about? God says, in the abundance that you have in saving that money, do something as well. Deuteronomy 14, I'm going to read in verse 27. And you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part or inheritance with you. In other words, I should expect checks. No, I shouldn't expect that. That's not what that says. It says, in essence, that if the Levite's been neglected, care for him. Verse 28, and at the end of every third year you shall bring the tithe of produce. And if we keep going, and the Levite, because he has no portion, no inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. What we wind up with here is a reminder that this tithing process, whether it be third tithe or second tithe, is an opportunity for you to share in the blessings that you have with spiritual brothers and sisters. So this feast, even as you think about it, as you, say, go to services, and you've passed by this person 2, 3, 4 days in a row and not said anything, maybe spent a smile. That's all you've spent. It's good for us to go and talk. And not like we're speed dating, but if the conversation works and you begin to realize this person is alone, to invite that person to dinner. To have them come share with you the blessing that you've had by keeping ties. And as a spiritual brother or a sister, to reaching out and benefiting that person. And so we're reminded of that here. If you go to Luke 14, I'll reference Luke 14 because it's talked about in terms of the feast that Christ gives. It says Christ offers a feast. And he does so, interestingly enough, inviting those who are in need. I'm heading for Luke 14. He says, pay attention to those who happen to be in need. Luke 14, we'll just read a few verses here. Luke 14, verse 7. Luke 14, verse 7. It says, he told a parable to those who were invited. When he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them. So he's talking about even the other side of the relationship here. When you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place. Let one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him, come and say to him, give place to this man. In other words, find a better spot. And then you begin with the shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher. Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And if you keep going here, verse 12, then he also said to him who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives. This is interesting because, you know, oftentimes I'll talk about, even in a relationship class, I'm in relationship class now, and we'll talk about one person. You primarily start with a person who is, you know, individual A, the primary communicator. But there's an interesting dynamic that Christ does here. He hits on all parties. He says it doesn't matter where you are. You have a responsibility of approaching that event, that feast, in a certain way. And so we're reading here. It says, don't just invite your friends, your brothers, and your relatives, nor your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back. Is it just tit for tat? That's not what he's saying. And you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. You know, if you go over, and I'll let you read Matthew 25, verses 31 through 40, you remember what happens where he talks about those who approached him in the inn and said, he separates sheep from goats, and they say, why am I not a sheep? Where does this work? And he said, you didn't do these things for me. And then remember the language on the tail end? As you've done them for the least of these, my brethren. So you've either, you know, received me or neglected me. The criterion for that parable is that they have only done things that made them look good, that are self-serving. So even as we think about our spiritual family in terms of approaching the feast, we have to ask ourselves, will we extend a hand to spiritual family? Now, we already know locally that trumpets, atonement, you say, I'm automobile for someone during atonement. You're not going to come back with me on that one. But when you get to the feast in the eighth day, man, that's green. That's wide open for helping other people. And you know the beauty of oftentimes those extending ourselves in invitations, I'm always struck by 2, 3, 5, 8, 10 years later, someone says, well, let me tell you how, you know, Joe and I got together. Joe at the feast invited me to a meal. And we built a friendship from there. In fact, we built a whole network of friends that we both know. I know some in his area and he knows some in mine. And it starts with a simple invitation. Do we have a responsibility spiritually to care for our brothers and sisters beyond our family? Yeah, during these feasts. Because these feasts are family feasts. So I pose the question as we tag this one, are you planning to make the feast a family feast? I would ask that you do. Because God requires it. Let's go to question 4. Will you keep the fall feast in a balanced manner? A balanced manner. And I have to note here, my answers are not mutually exclusive, so there's going to be a little bleed on these. The notion of balance from dictionary.com is to state where things occur in proper amounts or proper levels of importance. Balance, a state where things occur in proper amounts or in proper levels of importance. There's the term tagged, if you drop down dictionary.com, it says stable. Will your feast be stable? Well, we really need to make an effort along these lines. And I note this because if we plot, if we run an XY plot, we generally know how this works. I'm going to think, if I'm going right to left, yeah, mirror image. Okay, we oftentimes, we'll go through trumpets, and we'll have a high in atonement, we'll have a high, then we'll get to the feast. You know how this works. It happens every year. We all admit to this. We get to the feast, about 3-4 days in, we start to dip. Oh, energy. Got it. I'm feeling sick, sore throat. Everything starts to fall apart. Oh, then we come up right at the tail end for that 8th day. So I'm going to ask that you pay attention to this year. And physically, we do so, making sure we keep tabs in terms of what we do. I'll go back to Nehemiah. I was in Nehemiah. I should have left a marker there. I guess I only have so many fingers. If you're in Nehemiah 8, we're going to go right back there. Ezra, Nehemiah, still there. Ezra 8, and we're going to read just a few verses here. Ezra 8, verse 9. This is right before we were reading. And the aim was not to neglect, but rather to come back. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and the scribe and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn nor weep." This is what I referenced a little bit earlier, and you well know. "For all the people wept." They were hearing it going, "Oh man, we could have done this." When they heard the words of the law, then he said to them, "Go your way, eat the fat and drink the sweet, and send portions to those whom nothing is prepared." This goes right with the back last point we dealt with, the last question. "For this day is holy to our God. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." So the Levites quieted all the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." And all the people went their way to eat and drink and to send portions to rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. I mean, this had gone a long time without them necessarily recognizing that they were to do this. And then they begin to recognize it and they start to realize, well, we could have been doing this for years. So I note that in this point, in terms of asking, will you be balanced? It is helpful for us at least to question that we're not overdoing it. So I got to be straight up with you. Some years I've overdone it. In fact, do you ever do this? You're looking at your clothes, what I'm taking to the feast, which pants have the greatest waistband for me to stretch into? Because realistically, I know that I'm going to eat like I don't eat necessarily the rest of the year. But at the same time, we need to at least be cautious of what we're eating. We need to be mindful. And if we need to go back to Daniel 1, where he says, you know, I could go vegetables for a day or two. Rather than do the bloomin' onion at Outback every meal, I might throw a vegetable in. I remember going to the feast every once in a while, and the individual who was with me when the plate was served was like, "What's that?" And it was like, "Those are vegetables." "Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know we had those." The idea here is that, again, as we go to the feast, there should be moderation. You've heard this phrase before. It's not the feast of booze. It does tell us to enjoy strong drink, but it shouldn't be like we're passed out every night of the feast trying to sleep off and hope we make services the next day. It's God's feast when we are to enjoy clean, good, and right moderation in terms of food. How about your sleep? Oh man, he's really meddling now. Well, I would offer that you maintain some normal sleep regimen. Some normal sleep regimen. I'll quote Psalm 4, verse 8. I both lie down in peace and sleep. If there's a time all year when you should be able to sleep at peace, probably during the Feast of Tabernacles. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. So what I would offer here is, even as we enjoy the feast, we should strive to at least maintain some normal pattern. Now, I know if you're younger, I get this. You go to the feast, hey, I don't get to see my friends all year. Totally get all that. But at least think about the idea of trying to get yourself in bed, say, before sunup. Because we still have services to keep. That's the reason why we go. It's really counterintuitive to go to the feast and then run ourselves ragged, and then, you know, halfway through the feast, start wondering, am I going to make this? Wow, that sore throat's really hurting. I guess it goes without saying that getting more than a couple hours of sleep at night is paying a penalty. We should certainly take sleep into consideration physically. And we should strive, believe it or not, to get some exercise when you're there. That sounds a little radical. Where you're doing something. We know 1 Timothy 4 verse 8 talks about physical training is good, but training in godliness is better. It is helpful, though, that we move. It is not, you know, there was a movie, and I'm looking at Jordan and Jasmine on this one. What was the movie where everyone in the movie, the animated movie, where everyone got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger at the end? At Wall-E? There we go, thanks. If you saw Wall-E, what's that, like two-thirds of the way into the movie? Everyone in the movie is just massive. However Wall-E works, somehow they go to a society where no one exercises and all they do is eat, consume, and everyone's huge. And sometimes I go to the feast and think, is this how the feast is going to work for me? Am I going to be like a tick, massive, by the end? That's not how it should work. There should be some exercise along the way. Do something crazy and work in a walk every once in a while. Allow yourself to walk the beach or walk the mountains or walk a trail, because that's all helpful. I was listening to a TED Talk. I never know why I get certain TED Talks. Probably they've figured out my algorithm. They're like, he needs that. But I was watching one by Wendy Suzuki the other day, who happens to be a neuroscientist. And she's done all this neuroscience research. She was going one way in terms of research agenda. And she goes, hold on a second, I got to go the exact opposite way. And the core of her presentation, if you get to go listen to that TED Talk, is that she found, and she was struck by this, because she said, I was kind of a loner. I was seeking to get tenure and promotion, and I realized I had no friends. And she did something crazy. She said, you know, I guess I need to go on one of those river rafting Colorado trips, because I have no friends. And maybe I'll have some fun. And she began to figure out, this neuroscientist with all the research, hey, maybe I should be exercising. And in doing so, and she shares this while she's there, in exercising, she begins to figure out that not only does exercise, even in shorter bursts, enhance mood and memory, it also, all of her research shows that it combats all neurodegenerative diseases. She said, wait a second here. If I just move a little, she said I wasn't moving at all, gaining weight, et cetera, et cetera. She said, if I just moved a little, a minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, the impact was immediate and was also long term. I'm actually preventing myself down the road from getting Alzheimer's. So I note this because when at the feast, our predisposition may not be to exercise. And I would offer, and I'm including myself in this, Phil, go take a walk. Go have some fun. Go enjoy that part, because the feast will go so much better. How about spiritual balance? Well, one of the hardest things in the world, you know this, is if you have a family of six and one bedroom. And I look at the Talbots because sometimes I wonder how any family does this. A few years ago, we went to the Bahamas for the feast. Sarah's going to remember this vividly. And we went to the Bahamas for the feast, and we had a ton of fun at the Bahamas. I had a ton of fun beating Ryder Briggs at ping pong every time I had a chance. But when we got to the feast, I will never forget the reaction when we went to the bedroom with two, I think they were queen-size beds, sitting there, and all four of us walked in. It was so funny. We all walked in, and then we all looked at each other. And then we all looked at the bed, and then we all looked at each other like, we're here for 8 days. How is this going to work? So I would offer the following. You know this. In terms of living arrangements, sometimes the feast means we're a lot closer for a while. And it makes it hard to carve out prayer and study. And I would ask that you, because God reminds us of this, that we strive to make sure we don't minimize this. I'll go to 2 Corinthians 4. If you'll go there with me, 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4, we'll read verses 16 and 17. One thing we don't want to neglect, even though we are getting a spiritual smorgasbord at the feast, we don't want to neglect what our responsibility is at the Feast of Tabernacles or prior. Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement. When you're not eating, you got a little more extra time. That we take the time to make sure we're connecting with God. Verse 16, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16 reads, therefore we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man, this is what Mr. Steve Myers was noting, our inward man is being renewed day by day. For our affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. What we see here and we're reminded of is that we have to carve out some time. I don't know if it means that you, in the morning for you to pray, that you set up a prayer schedule where you take turns, you know, from this block of time we'll pray, or you have to leave. I know some years we've been so close, I've thought, in the morning I'll get up, I'll go sit on the beach, and I'll pray from the beach. Talk about changing your perspective. But don't lose this time. Don't miss this time. Because otherwise, when you get to services that day, you'll come ill-equipped. Make sure you take the time in order to not let down that spiritual pattern so that you're recharged. And as you take notes or have a chance to review those notes, talk about them with others and think about how you apply them. Don't let down. So I let you answer that question about spiritual balance. Will you have it this year during the fall feast? Let's go to one last one because we've gotten a transition then to get us there. Will you live the meaning of the fall feast this year? You know, we've already talked about, despite the fact that society has been in chaos, I wanted you to do something. Go and have fun. Go and rejoice. Remember why you're there. I will go to a verse that we're well aware of, Matthew 6, verse 33. Matthew 6, verse 33. We're right near the end of this message. Matthew 6, verse 33. And you know what's here. In fact, we happen to have seen us read this right up to this in the Beyond Today program. But 6:33, the Sermon on the Mount, this is right in the heart of the Sermon on the Mount, where he asks, what is your focus? And we're reminded of our focus during these days, or what should be galvanized in our minds and our thoughts. And it's this, verse 33, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. When addressing the point of what is our primary purpose as we do these things, we're reminded that our feast time is really about our calling, about us dedicating ourselves to God. And it doesn't happen just in our head and our heart. It's got to be manifest. So if you link what's offered here in Matthew 6:33, say with James 2 and verse 18, that faith, our faith, has to be manifest in our works. We should be examples when we're there. Examples at church, good examples, as opposed to the guy who once said, well, I'm an example. I'm an example of everything you shouldn't do at the feast. Shouldn't be that example. You should be a positive example. So as we're at the feast and have opportunity to listen and learn, we should show our light, Matthew 5:14-16. We should be reminded that we are to bear those fruits in Galatians 5:22-23. Not the actions that show up in verses 19 through 21. We should leave the feast where those we've been around, who we've been around, has said, man, it was good having, fill in your name there, it was good having that guy at the feast. He set a good example the whole time. It was synergistic. It was a great experience seeing his contribution or her contribution. I'll go to a section of scripture here, Hebrews 6. And I note this section of Hebrews 6 because sometimes we think, well, that's nice. I know I need to do these things. Hebrews 6 reminds us that someone beyond those around us is paying attention. Hebrews 6, we'll just read a few verses here. Hebrews 6, verse 9. But beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. Yes, things that accompany salvation. Though we speak in this manner, for God is not unjust to forget your work. What did that say? God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. And we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end. So let me get this right. God's paying attention to all this? Yeah, he is. He's keeping a scorecard about our example. So if we look through this, it's important again to be reminded that, again, if we're kind of going back to those in need, that God pays attention if we miss a service. God pays attention if we've helped someone out who needs a ride. God pays attention if we help someone at an activity. God pays attention if we go and lend an ear to someone who you've seen for 5 days at the feast and they've been alone every day. God pays attention if we come across someone who's older and needs help, or a single mom who's carrying all the bags and can barely make it through the door. God sees all of that. We don't have to have a title during the feast or a badge on our chest to live the truth that we've been given. God expects us to be caring and giving to others. It's an opportunity that we have to live the purpose of the feast. And if you don't know where to serve, ask God. He'll reveal this. He'll share with you where this needs to take place. So that's my last question. Will you live the meaning of the fall feast this year? You know, 2020 has really been a challenging year. I don't have to tell you that. What we've even experienced over the last 6 months and not knowing where can I go, can I go, can I do anything, it's been hard. It's been hard whether it's COVID or whether it's news and riot related or unduly deaths of someone, or as we see on the news, or whatever it might be. There's no end in sight in terms of what we've been through. But in the next month, month and a half, we get 4 special gifts. Times of refreshment and restoration that reminds us of why we're sitting here today. Why are we doing this? The only one who can answer the questions that I've posed are you and me. I will read one section. I oftentimes don't read a verse in closing, but I will ask you to go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 33, as we close, is a section that talks about God restoring Judah and Israel. It's a beautiful prophecy, and it's one that I leave with you today, even as we conclude this message, asking, are you ready for the fall feast? I'm in Jeremiah 33, and we'll just read a few verses. Jeremiah 33, verse 6. Behold, I will bring it health, that being these nations who are restored, and I will heal them and reveal to them the abundance of peace and truth. You had a hard year? Look forward to these upcoming days, because they will be times of healing and truth, peace and truth. And I will heal them and reveal to them the abundance of peace and truth. And I will cause the captives of Judah and the captives of Israel to return. Do we happen to know that physically they will return? Spiritually, God will allow us to be closer to Him as we keep these days properly. And we'll rebuild those places as at the first. And I will cleanse them from all their iniquities by which they have sinned against me. And I will pardon all their iniquities by which they have sinned and by which they have transgressed against me. Then it shall be to me a name of joy, of praise and honor before all the nations of the earth, who shall hear all the good that I do in them, and they shall fear, those other nations, fear and tremble for all the goodness and all the prosperity that I provide for it. What we're reminded is we serve a great God who's waiting to bless us if we prepare ourselves and keep these feast days properly. Certainly we need to, I would ask that we all have a great fall feast season.